Last Sunday, as we're walking through the Bible's big story, we saw God working in a family, working in Joseph, who would become the rescuer, working in his brothers, and a work of transformation from all the dysfunction to a very different group towards the end of this story, working in Jacob. And Jacob, and towards the end of Genesis, we actually see Jacob's finest hour. All the trickery is over, and he has in Egypt what Egypt wanted. And at the close of his life, you see two things, one of which we touched on and one of which we didn't have time. The first thing that we touched on was that here was a man who knew where he was going, who had a glimpse of eternity. And in a society that was preoccupied with death, and you only have to think of the pyramids, he was a man who knew what eternity was. But not only that, there was a second marker to Jacob in his finest hour, and that is that he understood the grace of God. And that was something that Joseph himself, in seeking the blessing of his own sons from his dad, had to learn. But his finest hour, discovering he has what Egypt wanted, and knowing where he was going. But the story of Joseph is a story of a dysfunctional family, of the consequences of sin and its choices, and yet God slowly working to reconcile them. And here's a family that was dysfunctional, willing to sell their own brother into slavery, and yet become a blessing, then saving many through their work. But none of that should surprise us, because we are holding on to the promise right in Genesis chapter 12 that we've said the rest of the Bible needs to unpack. So when we see God blessing his people and they becoming a blessing to others, none of that should surprise us, because we are familiar with Genesis 12 and verse 2 that says, "And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing." And so none of what we see happening in the unfolding story should take us by surprise if we keep ourselves familiar with the promises that God has made. It helps us to understand the big story. They've known God's blessing. The family has grown. God's fulfilling his purpose. And God is fulfilling his promise. And so none of what we read of here should be a surprise to us. God is blessing, and yet at the same time, for Israel, for the tribes, for the family, the skies are darkening. Those who had been the rescuers are now in need of rescue. The good guys have become the bad guys. The guys who saved are now those in need of saving. And in Egypt, they look at the circumstance and they look at the blessing that Israel is bringing, and their answer is, we've got a problem with immigration. Why such fear? And you could almost hear the culture of Egypt saying, you know, why can't this people just become like us? They dress differently, they behave differently, they worship differently. Why can't they just become like this? And for the people of Israel, they have become strangers in a strange land. But again, it shouldn't surprise us. Listen to what Jesus says in John chapter 15. He says, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." The good guys have become the bad guys. And it's not only that. What we discover in the early chapter of Exodus is that the stakes are being raised. And it's not just that there's this problem with immigration. They're treated ruthlessly. Kill every baby boy. And kill every baby boy, when you discover that that is not working, becomes kill every infant. And yet, they prosper. God still continues to bless them. And when you think of the early chapters of Acts, when the world hates the growing church, and you're left to think, well, how could the church even grow in such circumstances? And why is it, ironically, that the church seems to grow best in places where it faces most persecution? Why is it that when the good guys become the bad guys, God blesses them in such particular ways? And why is it our present contemporary church is so desperate to become the good guys, loved by everyone, that we are willing to abandon the very truth that makes us distinctive? And if we marry ourselves to the spirit of an age, we'll discover that we are a widow in the next. When the world hates you, how can the church ever grow? And what is remarkable in these early chapters of Exodus, Exodus chapter 1 in particular, is that help comes to the most unexpected of places. There is no prince coming in a white horse and a big sword, but rather instead it comes from the weakness and a disparaged group of the midwives. And you've got the most powerful king, the most powerful nation, and the one thing he can't stand against is the weakness of midwives. And yet, that's not the big question. The big question of Exodus 1 and 2 is this. God has made a promise, and Pharaoh has said, kill every boy, kill every infant. God has made a promise that from this family, a rescuer will come. And what we discover in these chapters is that it is God's promise of Genesis chapter 12 that is under threat. And so where are all these things that we have touched on are important. The big thing is God has made a promise from whom the Savior will come. But if Pharaoh wipes them out, then there will be no Jesus. There will be no rescuer. And God's promise will have been proved to be undeliverable. And so that's the big question of the darkening skies. Is God's promise under threat? And there is a particular beauty in response to these darkening skies that suddenly a particular baby is born. There's a growing evil. Pharaoh's attitude is this: remove every threat and make captive every asset. And their culture, the economy comes first, and a culture of death. And yet, this baby is born in a place where there is a king who thinks he is all-powerful but hasn't for a moment reckoned with God. And his message is very clear. The Nile is a symbol of our power, so we will throw the children into the Nile without mercy, and no one can rescue them. No one can save them from the power of my hand. And in response, light shines, and there's faith in dark places. There's two midwives. There's a mother. There's a big sister. There's a rebellious daughter. And faith in dark places outwits a king who thinks he is all-powerful. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 27 says this: but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God showed what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. Here's the question: what makes a difference in the face of evil? Well, Exodus tells us it's love. Love that will not give up. It is pity that would not be complicit. It is courage that takes the opportunity. And there is a God who saves. And a baby is placed in a basket, which is the same word as an ark, which is the same word as a coffin. And a baby is rescued by being placed in the river and hidden amongst the bulrushes. And here is God's rescuer. A rescuer who for 40 years is trained as a prince. And he's trained to lead. Here is a rescuer who for the next 40 years of his life is trained as a shepherd. Trained to care. Trained to walk out in front of a flock that's looking for different ways to die. Do you know what that's what shepherds call sheep? Animals that look for a new way to die. They once did a study about the gait of animals to compare animals within a particular breed. Do you know the one animal that's gait was so unlike the other that they couldn't believe it? They couldn't find two with the same gait. Do you know which one? Sheep. Sheep only have uniformity in that they are looking for new ways to die. And our idea of a shepherd is somebody who drives the sheep with the sheepdog. But actually, in the ancient Near East, the shepherd walked out in front and the sheep learned to follow. It's a different culture, a different way of seeing it. So for 40 years, he's trained as a prince. His 40 years, he's trained to lead as a shepherd. And he's a man with a fatal flaw because he's a man with a temper. And there's that part of me that goes, I can get it. Imagine the start of your life is that people want to kill you and throw you, put you in the bulrushes. Imagine the first part of your life is that you're always the outsider. You're always the one whose people question where you came from. Imagine the next 40 years of your life, you're doing the very thing you wish you weren't doing amongst the very people you wish you weren't there. But he's a man with a temper. And it gets him all into all kinds of bother. And the context of everything that we're looking at this morning is given for us. And it's given in chapter 2 and verse 24, where four things happen. It is the God who hears, it is the God who cares, it is the God who acts, and it's the God for whom his promises matter. Look at what it says in chapter 2 and verse 24. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. And God chose to do the right thing. Look at the passage. You really need to look at it because it's the only way that the big story makes sense. And God remembered his covenant. He remembered his promise with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel and God knew. He hears, he cares, he acts, and at the heart of it, a promise. A promise he will not break. A commitment he will not undo. And here in Exodus chapter 3, we discover is that God is on the move. And this is a move that has been 80 years in the planning, 80 years of preparation. And for Moses, he's going about his ordinary day-to-day living, and God breaks down and says, Moses, follow me. There is no course that he goes on. The 80 years has been the course. It is like the call of the disciples where Jesus comes alongside. And not as an invitation, but as a command, follow me. And God so often breaks into the ordinariness of our life. We've got our own plans and purposes, and we've got our 5 years plans and our 10-year plans mapped out. Sometimes you just don't even know what I'm doing today, never mind a 5-year plan. But God just breaks in and says, Moses, follow me. But the two great themes that we said of the Bible are revelation and rescue. And here's what is important in Exodus chapter 3, is that it is God's revelation that matters. There's a burning bush. What's it pointing to? Is it the self-sufficiency of God? Is it the eternal nature of God? Is it the supernatural work of God? It's not entirely clear, and we can guess and we can conjecture, but what we discover that is revealed to us is that here is a God who calls, here is a God who is holy, and here is a God of promise who is not ashamed to be the God of a slave people. Let me say that again. He is not ashamed to be their God. They've got nothing to offer, nothing to give. He is not ashamed to be their God. He calls, he is holy, a God of promise, and he's not ashamed. And just as he is these things, what we also see revealed about God is that he cares. I have seen. I have heard. I know. He's the God who acts. I have come down. What is it that we'll sing in a few weeks' time? Love came down at Christmas. Love, all lovely, all divine. I came down. Think of Betsy Ten Boom. There is no place so dark that God is not deeper still. I have come down. What will we say in a few weeks' time? He is called Christ, our Emmanuel, God with us. I have come down. He's among us. And just as he's the God who acts, he's the God who plans. I will deliver. I will bring them out. I will take them home. This is my work. But he's also the God who sends. I'm going to send you, Moses. And you've got what you need in your hands. And Moses tries to argue with God and says, you know, I've not this, not that. And God is really patient with him until Moses says, you've got the wrong person, and God gets angry. God doesn't make mistakes. I am with you. And so what do we see revealed? We see revealed the purpose of God to save and to rescue. But is he able? Is he able? And I don't think it's unfair that when we think of our own circumstance and our own situation, that we say, God, who can rescue me from this? Not just the circumstance of our life, but who can rescue me from my sin? And the story unfolds. In the story, you would expect that God sends a rescuer, that everyone would go, yes! Rescuer's here, it's great, Moses, we're in. We've been waiting for this moment. So what do they do instead? They doubt him. And it has an effect on Moses. And it has an effect on the people themselves. And the story unfolds with a doubting people, but what also unfolds is the hard heart of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's only ever interested is in an economy. It's amazing how many of our ethics are dictated by the economic impact that it has. Economy first. But it's not just that selfish reason. What we discover in Pharaoh is deliberate unbelief. And one commentator describes it like this. I can't remember who it was, said, in Pharaoh, you have a thoroughly modern man. Listen to what Pharaoh says from Exodus chapter 5 and verse 1. It's so contemporary. Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let him go. Who do you think you are, God? And Pharaoh falls under God's judgment. And God's judgment is this, is that in the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, he allows Pharaoh to do the very thing that Pharaoh wants to do. The judgment of God can be that he does not save us from ourselves, but he hardens us in the choices that we would make. And his heart becomes hard. And for the people and for the nation, warnings are given. There are 9 plagues so far, 9 times, 9 opportunities that he has told, let my people go. And 9 times when he seems to be on that mark of repentance and change, he refuses to. It doesn't matter. 9 times. I'll let them go, but then his heart becomes hard. And he's left without excuse. And with each unfolding plague, with each unfolding judgment, we see a God who fights for his people. We see a God who conquers the gods of Egypt. And this isn't an equal fight by any manner of means. It says this in Exodus chapter 8 and verse 10. It says, and he said, tomorrow, Moses said, be as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like our God. And God dismantles the gods of Egypt. Why? Because there's no one like him. Have you ever heard somebody say, you know, the one distinctive about Christian faith is grace? And that's what all other religions don't have that. That's not true. Because it's not just grace that makes Christianity distinctive. It's the holiness of God. It's the glory of God. It's the majesty of God. There is no one else like him. It's not as if other religions are like him in this way, and this is the one thing that sets God apart. No, he reigns over everything. Now, I understand why we say that, but I think it's an unhelpful form of reductionism. You know, people say things like Christianity is a relationship, not a religion. Muslims will say it's not a religion, it's a way of life. And he said, be is it as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. In all parts. And he dismantles the gods of Egypt. And then comes a day that divides. The day of Passover. Here's the question. Do you remember how it started? What, how did the passage begin? How did the story begin? It began with this in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, cast into the Nile. And comes now a day of judgment where we reap what we sow. But what makes this day different is that there is now the possibility of rescue. That there is a lamb who would come. Acts chapter 4 and verse 10 says this. This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you. Now think of it for a moment. Think of the Egyptians who would have watched the Israelites put the blood over their door lintels and say, how foolish are you? Do you think that's going to save you? Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Jesus chose before the cross to do what? To celebrate the Passover with his friends. It says this in Luke 22, verse 7. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb has to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John saying, go and prepare the Passover for us. And here is a day like no other. Here is a day where the people went free. And just as when we break the bread and drink the wine, there is a drama in the food that they eat. Because God is a God of revelation and a God of rescue, which presents us with a decision to make. Revelation. I never quite understand why people believe that God is a moral monster. It's not the Bible that I read. And not the God that I know. I have heard. I have seen. I know. And I have come down. The Bible's big story book describes the rescue like this. God's people would always remember this great rescue and call it Passover. But an even greater rescue was coming. Many years later, God would do it again. He was going to come down once more to rescue his people. But this time God was going to set them free forever and ever. Let me ask you, who is the captive in the story? Is it Pharaoh? Or is it the people? Pharaoh would never know what it is to be free. Held captives by the desires and passions of his own heart. He would never know what it is to have the dungeon opened. He would never know what it is to be set free by the living God. But he was captive to his own pride and his own sin. So as the blood is put upon the lintel, as the opportunity for rescue is given, what do you want? Do you want your heart to remain hard and to say, I'll save myself? Or do you want to come to the Christ who offers you freedom? The people go free, and the Pharaoh stays captive. I did it my way. Revelation. Here I am. Rescue. Come to Christ. And if you've not got it yet, then you're still in darkness. You're still captive. Come to me. Come to Christ. Let's pray.